When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Welcome to Our Shelves, a podcast where writers from the legendary feminist publishing house Virago talk about their cultural worlds. We'll be diving into these writers' bookshelves, record collections, and recollections to discover what inspires them. I'm Lucy Scholes, and my guest today is Claire Chambers. Claire is the author of 9 novels, including 2 for young adults. Her most recent, Small Pleasures, was longlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction and recently won the Page Turner of the Year at the 2022 British Book Awards. So welcome to Our Shelves, Claire. It's such a pleasure to have you here today.
It's lovely to be here.
So the Virago Modern Classics, very famous list under the brilliant editorship of Donna Coonan, who was a guest on this podcast last season for regular listeners. They are currently reissuing 9 of Barbara Pym's absolutely brilliant novels. And you have written the introduction to one of them, A Glass of Blessings. And I feel like Pym is one of those writers who is beloved by so many people, people who will, you know, talk about her until the cows come home about how much they love her. But at the same time, she still seems to be someone who is slightly underappreciated. And so I'm thinking, particularly for any listeners who haven't yet fallen under her spell, could you tell us a little bit about what the appeal is for you, more generally, and also about A Glass of Blessings in particular, please, Claire?
Yes, I'd be delighted to rave about Barbara Pym. She's just one of those writers who, once you've been introduced to her work, you immediately go and read absolutely everything else she's written, because there's nobody else quite like her. So you can't go and find an alternative Pym. Her voice is absolutely unique. I mean, people compare her to Jane Austen, and but that doesn't really do. She's much much funnier. I mean, I love Jane Austen, but Barbara Pym is more funny, and she's more middle class, and she has sort of particular areas of interest, like anthropology and academia and high Anglicanism, which are just sort of just delightfully rendered by her, and in this sort of a slightly mocking way. And she has a great line in Underdogs, these sort of female characters who are sort of doormats in a world of boots, as Jean Rhys would put it. And every book is slightly different, but they all have this inimitable style and quality of just sharp observation, and sort of sometimes they're more playful than others, and sometimes they're more dark and waspish, but there's always this really knowing voice. It's not even an acquired taste. You get into the taste within a paragraph, really. She's so wonderful. I came across a line that she'd written that just made me laugh out loud. She's talking about tea, and she says, a drink she did not much like because of the comfort it was said to bring to those whom she normally despised.
She's so sharp, isn't she? And so sharp under that layer. I think a lot of people still have this idea of her as somebody who writes about sort of, you know, tea parties with vicars, which she does, but it's kind of brilliantly told, right? There's such a sharpness there.
Yes, and I think people over-identify Barbara Pym with the sort of spinsterish blue stocking of her books, and she wasn't like that at all. She was much more worldly and interested in fashion and men and, you know, disastrous love affairs, and was not quite the character that she sort of portrays in her books, which just makes her more interesting, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I read Paula Byrne's recent biography of her with absolute interest. I had no idea about her sort of, well, A, her interest in Nazism to begin with, but also all her sort of affairs that she was having at a time when really this was still kind of looked down upon, or kind of it was shot considered shocking for a girl of her sort of class and stature to be having these sexual affairs with men, right?
Yes, she was, you know, it was frowned upon and made very awkward at university to be sort of sleeping around, but she still managed it, you know, and always kind of disastrously. She kept choosing people who were emotionally unavailable because they were either just commitment phobes, or they were married, or they were gay, or, you know, one person after another she would sort of attach herself to and fall deeply in love with, and they just wouldn't be able to reciprocate her feelings. So it was she was not a good picker of men.
No, not at all. So tell us a little bit about A Glass of Blessings, and is this a good place to start with Pym, and what should people read this book in particular for?
It is a good place to start in the sense that it's one of her best. So if you're going to, you know, come at her, you may as well go in on the high and see her at her best, and then if you like her, you can read the rest. But it's not an early one. It's I think it's her at the sort of height of her brilliance, really. And it's not typical either, because it's got this heroine, Wilmot Forsyth, who is quite unlike a typical Pym heroine, because she's rather successful, she's rather attractive, middle class, quite well off, quite complacent, and she's rather like Jane Austen's Emma. She's someone who's rather too comfortable and rather bored, and so she gets involved in sort of interfering in people's affairs and matchmaking, and with sort of slightly disastrous outcomes. But it's very funny and very moving, and she just nails this whole sort of milieu of the bored housewife who is just wasted and underemployed, and therefore starts to sort of get involved in other people's affairs in a way that is not helpful. But it's very much like Emma in that respect, and it's very funny, and you know, it's got a really good plot, a nice tight plot with sort of misunderstandings. The sort of comedy of misunderstandings is quite a typical Pym device. And she does that. And the reader can see quite clearly why this chap that she's pursuing for a sort of idle bit of romance is not interested in her, and how it's going to play out. But the character can't see it herself. It's wonderfully lightly done, and it's full of one-liners and little observations about churchy people, and you know, she comes at it with an anthropologist's eye, you know, the sort of rituals of the church and the way that the practice of religion is in many ways much more than its spirit. You know, there's an awful lot of people worried about whether their cassock has been used by somebody else, or these petty little things that shouldn't really trouble people of the spirit,
yes,
but obviously do.
I'd never thought of it like that, but you're completely right. She does. She brings the kind of anthropologist's insight and precision of thinking about how people kind of why people do things and how they do things to when she describes that sort of, you know, especially around the church, but also I think with small communities as well, and how they work together and the interplay between various people. Right.
Yeah. So every group of people is a sort of tribe to which she brings her anthropologist's eye and dissects their funny little ways.
Yeah. That's exactly it. And can I ask, how long have you been a long time fan of Pym's work? Is it something that you do you remember when you first read her?
Yes, I think I was in about my 30s, which I think is the perfect age for, you know, being introduced to her. I don't think she's a teenage read at all. I think you have to have a bit of disappointment under your belt to really identify with the Pym world. And I think I was first given a copy of Excellent Women when I was about 30, and I absolutely loved it, and I immediately read everything else I could get my hands on, but out of order. I didn't kind of read them in the right order, and then when I was writing this introduction, I went back and read them chronologically so that I could sort of get a feel of her, the way her writing changed. And it does have a sort of bell curve shape from her early light, funny, slightly frivolous early books, and then you get this real perfection of A Glass of Blessings and Excellent Women. And then her later books develop a very dark and almost cruel and sort of waspish edge. And they're, you know, they're sort of more mature and richer, maybe. But those are the sort of three stages of Pym, I would say.
That's fascinating, because I've always read her slightly out of order as well, and never thought of really thinking about how she progressed. And I think I do personally prefer those sort of darker, the sharper ones towards the end of her career, a little bit more in my line. But, you know, the early ones are just as just as glorious. So there's something for everyone there. And also your novel, Small Pleasures, your most recent novel, you drew comparisons. Critics drew comparisons between your work and Pym's, which I can imagine as a Pym fan must have been such wonderful praise to read, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was absolutely, you know, the nicest thing you could ever have said about my writing. But I think it was perhaps generated more by the setting of the sort of 1950s suburbs than perhaps the, you know, the brilliance of the writing. I have to hand on heart say that may have been a factor.
Don't do yourself down. No. No, I mean, I think I can see what you're saying. There's definitely a setting that might be similar, but no, you shouldn't do yourself down as well. I can imagine that that's a sort of, for anyone who's a Pym fan, I feel like that's almost like a career ending moment. You want to just leave it there, go out on a high.
Exactly. I'm very happy with that comparison.
No, not that I'm encouraging to do that. I can't wait to see what you write next. Anyway, well, I hope that gives our listeners a little bit of a taste of Pym if you haven't enjoyed already, and do look at these beautiful new editions that Virago have done. They've got lovely new covers as well, so I feel like anyone who likes good beautiful books will be interested in having them on their shelves as well. Let's move into our main questions now, Claire, if we may. First up, I'm going to ask you to tell me about a book that is currently on your bedside table. What have you chosen for us?
Well, I've chosen The Exhibitionist by Charlotte Mendelssohn. It's a really interesting book about art and artists and the sort of clash of egos when you have more than one artist in a family. It's about a sort of really monstrous male painter who's experiencing a slump in his career and is trying to get it back on track by mounting this exhibition, and the whole family has to sort of rally round and contribute to this relaunching of him to try and sort of make something of his late career. And there's almost nothing more interesting than a dysfunctional family in meltdown. And this book does sort of deliver that brilliantly. It's set over the course of just one weekend. So it almost has the structure of a play, because it's got a fairly, you know, consistent setting of the house of the Hanrahan family, where all this is going to take place, apart from the exhibition itself. And then each of his wife and his and the three children of the family, or stepchildren, are also given a voice. And each one of them has got some inconvenient secret or confession or revelation that they sort of need to make, which is going to throw a spanner into the works of this party and exhibition. And so she sort of, the author sort of sets up this machine and sort of winds up the clockwork and then sets it going. And, you know, there's only one way it can go, which is badly, you know. And it's so delicious to watch it unfolding, because the main character of the sort of patriarch of the family is such a monster that you can't wait for whatever terrible thing is going to happen to him. You nothing bad could be bad enough for this man. So it's really enjoyable to read. And I particularly like reading about unpleasant people. I know a lot of people have a real problem with novels where the characters are not likeable, or they're not relatable because they're not nice. And I think, no, it's really interesting to read about people who are really unpleasant. And some of my favourite books and the most successful books are about, you know, deeply unpleasant people. You know, the Secret History hardly has a nice character in it. And, you know, Notes on a Scandal, and they're all full of really unpleasant people, but they're so interesting to read about.
I wonder what it is that makes them so fascinating, because I completely agree with you. There's nothing more, I personally find there's in a way nothing more dull than a very likable character, unless they're rendered, but, you know, obviously there are always exceptions to the rule, but there's something immediately kind of satisfying and intriguing about someone who is a bit of a monster. And you're right that Ray Hanrahan in this is awful, but also there's a kind of elements of awfulness to all the characters in different ways. I think I found that quite lovely in when I read this, that it wasn't just the kind of he's the baddie and everyone else is, you know, brilliant and kind of, you know, trying to cope with, I mean, they're all trying to cope with him, but they've all got these kind of horrific sort of elements to their character that makes you want to shake them and, you know, tell them to sort themselves out.
Yes, I mean, you sort of feel for his wife, because she's also an artist who's completely buried her own talents and career to try and massage his colossal ego. And it's, you know, her dialogue is so interesting. She almost never gets to the end of a sentence in any of her dialogue. She's either interrupted by someone else, or she just kind of hits this brick wall of kind of cognitive dissonance where she can't articulate the contradictions that are inherent in her existence, because she's an artist who's working, but she's working to fail, because the consequences of succeeding would be domestically so disastrous. She can't afford to do well at anything. So it's just really, it makes very good reading. And it's a book that I read and has sort of stayed with me, and the characters are sort of firmly in my mind, which doesn't often happen. I'm quite forgetful about things I read because I read them so fast. And these are, you know, still with me, and I'm still indignant at this man's, you know, monstrous behaviour.
Yeah, well, that's a very good review for it, I think, in that sense. It was published earlier this year, wasn't it? So it's quite a recent book. Do you read a lot of contemporary fiction? Are you constantly sort of keeping up with what's being published, or are you a bit of a magpie?
I'm a, you know, a bit ancient and modern. I do read much more now of contemporary fiction. I try to keep up with things, and I'm also sent a lot of things now, which is nice. I mean, I wasn't sent this, I did actually buy this myself, but I'm occasionally sent new books, and that's nice. But yeah, I do read things that are contemporary, current, and that have got some attention, or people have drawn to my attention. But I also read, you know, Trollope and old you know, classics, go back to my old favorites and things like that as well. I sort of keep several things on the go at once.
Yeah. Are you one of those readers who has a big pile of books that you're kind of dipping in and out of, or do you like to finish something and then move on to something else?
No, I always have about three things going at once. I have an audio book and a book on my Kindle, and a book, a hardback or paperback, and a non-fiction book that I'm using for research or just dipping into. So I always have more than one on the go.
Brilliant. Next up, you're going to tell me about a current TV adaptation that you're enjoying, which I think is a kind of hot topic with many people at the moment. Tell me what this one is.
Well, the current TV I'm enjoying or have just enjoyed is Conversations with Friends, the BBC adaptation of Sally Rooney's novel. I just sort of want to talk about it because I think, you know, she's had a lot of attention lately that's sort of not really focused on the writing. But I also really want to talk about the TV adaptation as itself, rather than as a sort of Sally Rooney vehicle in a way. It's just a very interesting adaptation. It's got all the things I kind of like in a TV adaptation, in that it's got an incredibly leisurely pace, which you wouldn't really be allowed if you didn't have a huge star like Sally Rooney as your kind of engine. It's, you know, there are whole sort of scenes where Frances, the main character, is just sort of on a bus or walking around a house having a glass of water, and nothing much happens. I mean, it nothing happens, you know, to a fault, really, all the way through. It's splendidly leisurely is the way I would put it. I don't mean that as a criticism. I enjoy the ultra realism of not much happening. There's a sort of moment where it's sort of like an anti-thriller, where Frances is in the house of Melissa and Nick, who are the couple with whom she becomes, the older couple with whom she becomes sort of entangled romantically and professionally. And for some reason, she's left alone in downstairs while Melissa is having a bath upstairs and Nick hasn't come in yet. So there's a moment where she's got the house to herself. And you're in a thriller or a normal kind of drama, this would be the opportunity where somebody prowls around and you know, comes upon some interesting thing or is caught in the act of spying, or there's some sort of moment that moves the plot on or is a sort of reveal, a big reveal. But nothing happens. She just sort of pokes around the house like you do in those situations, but doesn't find anything and doesn't get caught out in her act of snooping. It's a sort of anti-thriller device. And the book is full of those sort of moments of ultra-realistic nothing happening. And I think I sort of salute the writer because the book is a first-person narrative with Frances as the narrator. And so we get to know her thoughts and feelings and her very analytical take on life quite intimately. But that's the one thing that TV just doesn't do. It cannot do the inner life and the thoughts of a character without resorting to the dreaded voiceover, which is always an absolute admission that this was a book and I have no idea how to convert book to screen. And I salute the author, the scriptwriter, for not going down the voiceover route and just leaving it all to the actress Alison Oliver to try and deliver this great wealth of feeling that we never get to know about just from the emotions written on her face. It's quite a big ask of an actress, and I salute her. I think she's done a pretty good job with that remit.
Yeah, I was watching it last week, and I found, because I know a lot of people have complained about how slow it is and how long it is, and I was amazed to find it was 12 episodes. I mean, which seems like when you think of, you know, how often adaptations are so condensed down and everyone complains there's not enough screen time, to give this book 12 episodes, like you say, is because it's been such a phenomenon. But so little happens in it, but I found it completely mesmerizing at the same time. I sort of couldn't stop watching it, even though after a while you realize that you weren't waiting for those moments anymore, because it wasn't going to give you these shock factor moments. It was going to just remain very true to life. I can't work out. There's something I really loved about it, but I can also, I think I can appreciate why some people found it a little bit too leisurely, let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think we've just been used to having a certain amount of drama and conflict, you know, within every scene of any kind of TV drama. And we're just not used to a sort of episodic slice of life, which has no real beginning or end or plot arc or, you know, or anything that we're given to expect. I mean, even Normal People had a sort of more of a kind of meaty plot of the rise and fall of each character, yes, and their ascendancy and the coming together and parting was a sort of arc of action. But this is quite different from that. And, I found myself sort of hypnotized by the by the rhythm of it.
And I think there is something to be admired, like you say, in that way of rendering reality so realistically on the screen, right? To capture that, there is a real skill involved. It might not be the most thrilling thing to then watch, and it does throw up questions of like, what do we want our art to do? But at the same time, I think the fact that you can do that is demonstration of, you know, of talent in a particular way, the acting talent, the writing talent, these things that go into it.
And it's a book that's very much about, you know, inarticulacy. And so it's very difficult to write a script that honours the inarticulacy of the characters without, you know, somehow muting them. Because at least in the book we have Frances' thoughts, so we know what she was trying to say but utterly failed to. Whereas in the drama, all we have is her constant apologies for her lack of self-expression. She prefaces almost every bit of dialogue with sorry, and it is a real sort of homage to the inarticulacy of the 20-year-old sensitive academic woman. I enjoyed that aspect of it.
And I think it also made me think a bit more broadly about what do we want from adaptations. Like, it's very interesting that sometimes an adaptation is hailed as being brilliant because it cleaves so closely to the original, and sometimes an adaptation is seen as brilliant because it departs entirely and does something new and creates this kind of new art and sort of new artwork from it, whereas this is very much the former, but equally it's a piece of art that is very different to the original film, but at the same time, I think for me at least, it captures the essence of that original, right? And that seems to be what you're saying as well.
I think it's very respectful of Sally Rooney's work and tries to sort of honour the flavour of it, even though it's presented with this real sort of conundrum of how to get this character of Frances across without her thoughts. I mean, you know, that if we'd had voiceover, it would have just really been like an audio book with visuals. And so I really like the fact they didn't use it at all at any point.
There's nothing like voiceover to kill the mood sometimes. I think a lot of the time it's like, it's sort of the laziest thing you can do, I think, in a film is use voiceover.
Yeah, I think it just screams out, this was once a book.
Yeah. Arshel will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Our Shelves. I'm Lucy Scholes, and I'm talking to Claire Chambers about the lazy use of voiceover in films. Next up, Claire, can you tell me about a book that made you think about feminism in a new way?
To to say that it made me think about feminism in a new way is a bit of a stretch, because, you know, almost nothing makes me think about anything in a new way, because my brain's just so sluggish and unable to get out of its tracks. But a book that certainly made me think about feminism and many, many things besides was In the Dream House by Carmen Maria Machado, which was the winner of the Rathbones Folio Prize last year. And it's an incredibly interesting book about an abusive lesbian relationship. It's a sort of memoir, but it's completely genre-defying because it's written in a series of very short chapters in which the dream house is describing the setting of where this all took place, a sort of cabin in Indiana, I think, where they lived. But it's also a kind of metaphor for the architecture of memory. And it's a really very mannered and knowing and academic kind of treatise on an abusive relationship that hasn't got any precedence, because she finds that there's no kind of archival legitimacy for her experience, because women on women abuse isn't a topic, really. There just isn't the literature to give her the tools to explore her experience and make sense of it, which was why it was so traumatizing for her, because she couldn't process it, you know. And so she's written this incredible memoir, and each chapter is told in the style of a particular genre or trope from literary criticism, which makes it sound unreadable, but it isn't. It's incredibly witty, and it's almost like a parody of the academic style, as well as being academic. So you get sort of the dream house as noir or picaresque or Mrs. Dalloway or the unreliable narrator. And they're all little vignettes from this relationship told in these different styles, which is, it's just an incredibly clever and interesting way of doing it. And it's so analytical, and the way of processing sort of trauma is so clever and winning and brilliant. And also, she also references folklore. There are all these footnotes about how the tropes of folklore, you know, the breaking of the taboo, having to entertain strangers, asking for reasons for unreasonable actions and things, are all these tropes from folklore. And she's really good at just linking her experience to this sort of history of writing. That's the book that's really, really stayed with me and made me think about female experience. And I suppose feminism is all about thinking about female experience and what it means. And I suppose when I read this book, it made me think that my experience of feminism was very narrow, limited to my own perspective. And reading this just kind of opened my eyes to a whole other area of experience that I hadn't really considered, hadn't crossed my mind as being a thing. And then that's always a kind of moment of bringing yourself up short and thinking, I'm so ignorant. And that, you know, those moments are to be treasured, where you think, I know nothing, because then the book you're reading helps you to know more.
Yeah, completely. I thought it was such a brilliant book, this, and I was really taken aback, I think, like you, that in theory it shouldn't have worked, or it sounds much more dull or much more academic or too you know, style over substance. It just seems like it's going to be kind of, you know, just too heavy to kind of get your head around. And then when you read it, it's incredibly gripping. And each of those sort of vignettes that she puts together are just exceptionally readable, really kind of thrilling. And you're sort of racing through this book. But at the same time, I was brought up against ideas of, you know, thinking about things differently and having to consider different experience. And I guess that's the point, and like you said, the point of the book as well, that she wanted to create this sort of the beginning of this archive, or this kind of, you know, consideration of what it was like to be in a relationship of female on female kind of abuse, where she didn't have that, you know, she didn't have those kind of resources to fall back on when talking about her own experience or trying to, you know, write about it, right?
Yeah, and it also it's unusually it's told in the second person, so it's you did this, you did that. So as well as it sort of divides the narrator into two. There's the I who is sort of writing it, and the you to whom all these terrible things happened and sort of changed her personality. But also it's kind of sucking the reader into being the you, and it just makes you feel as though all these experiences are happening to you, because she keeps saying you did this and you did that and this happened to you. And so you're sort of drawn into it. And there is that kind of complicity when you're reading a memoir of suffering and trauma, that you're being entertained by essentially somebody else's bad luck, aren't you? And so you do feel a slight guilt that you're enjoying so much reading about it. And I think that's part of the sort of turning the tables on the reader, that you are the you as well.
Yeah, I hadn't considered that, but you're right. That sort of the idea that, I mean, you know, turning pain and trauma into sort of not entertainment exactly, but the idea that then we are, the reader is in a place of complicity perhaps in kind of, you know, involving themselves in this. But I also thought that it was very cleverly, it made me also consider that sort of shift between these different very short chapters written in these different in the style of the different genres, made me also kind of think that this must be to a certain extent what living in that sort of abusive relationship that she describes is like, where you sort of feel constantly like the rug is being pulled out from under you, that you don't know if your partner's going to be nice to you today or you know, be violent or abusive. And something that, you know, was once, I don't know, something that you think is kind of, you know, happy and you're content, and then they turn on a moment and start sort of shouting at you, or, you know, and that sense of genre being kind of pulled out and constantly replaced with another idea. I loved that, because it made it feel much more visceral to me, the experience that she was describing then.
It's like every time she thought she'd understood what was happening, because she'd understood it, oh, this is a road trip, or this is like film noir, it wasn't. It was suddenly something else. And there was a brilliant chapter called Choose Your Own Ending. It was like one of those sort of books from the sort of 1980s, where you choose your own adventure path. But of course, every path led to the same event. It led to inexplicably causing her partner to be enraged and violent or whatever. So it had this ridiculous idea that you could choose the ending, but of course you couldn't, because whatever you did, you were going to end up causing offence, you know, without meaning to. And every chapter was like that, this new kind of trying to find some new way of understanding her experience, and then the next chapter she'd have to do it all over again.
God, even just talking about it now makes me want to go back and read it again. It was such a visceral experience, I think, and made me think differently as well. That's a brilliant choice. After saying that you didn't have a kind of an answer that made you think about feminism differently, it sounds like you've just made a captivating argument for for that exact question. And finally, you're going to tell me about a woman or a person of an unrepresented gender whom you admire. And I just have to kind of add here that we call this question our on the pedestal one, and you're the first person whose answer has added this very interesting, but you said this was particularly tricky because pedestals are very unstable. And I like that. I think that's a very very alert observation to make.
Yeah, I mean, I think of recently that the spirit of the age seems to be rather in favour of toppling people off pedestals than putting them on pedestals. So I'm very uneasy about according anyone a pedestal to stand on, because they're such rocky places. But that says,
let's say just a low pedestal for this person then.
I mean, I think even if you think that somebody's safely, you know, two centuries old, still something can be uncovered about them that makes them not worthy of that pedestal. So I think it's even more problematic to put a living person on one. But that said, if one has to do that, then I think someone who's already kind of been through the fire of a terrible experience and turned it into a mission to help other people, then they are deserving of that. And so the person that I'm sort of nominating for this dubious award of being put on a pedestal is a woman called Fiona Spargo Mabbs, who has set up a charity called the Daniel Spargo Mabbs Foundation to help young people to make safer choices around drugs and alcohol. In 2014, her son Dan, who was 16, took MDMA at an illegal rave and died from that. And she has, from this terrible tragedy, you know, the worst thing that can happen to a parent, really, she has just grown this incredible charity that goes into schools, educates teachers and professionals to help young people make safer choices. And she's used her experience as a teacher to teach people. And she's done everything so rationally from evidence. She hasn't done a sort of emotional thing of, we must stop everyone doing this. Children must just say no to it. And she's looked at the evidence and what actually works, what doesn't work, and has done everything on that basis. She's incredibly wise, and her TED talk is really, really inspiring. I mean, I know that we use the word inspiring. It has become sort of cheapened by the idea of celebrities who've suddenly learned to dance a tango, and we say, oh, yeah, inspiring. But you know, she is genuinely inspiring, and has just turned this terrible experience into an incredibly good, you know, public service for other people. And she talks about it so movingly and so intelligently, and so, you know, I think that she's someone who deserves all the sort of credit, and it's a very worthy charity.
Yeah, you're right. It's very rare, I think, to have the ability to do that, to turn something so horrific into something so good, or to kind of help others and to put one's own, it's not, you know, it's acknowledging one's own pain and suffering, but to put it aside for a second and to think, like, what can I do with this? Mm-hmm. How can I turn this into something more positive for the future? Which is not, you know, yeah, not something that everyone can do. Can I ask you how you first came across her work?
I mean, I don't know her personally. I've never met her, but I worked at the school where her son Dan was a student. And So I was aware of him. I didn't teach him or have any personal relationship with him. I was just an administrator at the school. But obviously when there is a trauma like that at a school, it affects the whole community very deeply. And so I've been aware of her response to that, and how this charity has grown and sort of flourished. And it's they commissioned a play to be written based on Dan's life called I Love You Mum, I Promise I Won't Die, which was his last words to her as he gaily went off to his party.
Oh my God.
And this play has been performed around the world, and it's now on the GCSE syllabus. And so it's had an enormous effect on a whole sort of generation of students who've come to know Dan's story. So that's how my very slight connection with this charity is very sort of tangential, but it's how I became aware of it and, you know, can see the good that it's doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's wonderful. In that case, I encourage everyone to go and listen to her TED talk and to, you know, look up some more information about this very, very worthy charity. Worthy sounds like the wrong word, doesn't it, in a sense? It sort of implies, I mean that in the nicest possible way. You know what I mean? We're talking about inspiration and worthiness.
It's genuinely worthy. Yes. Just worthy in inverted commas.
Yeah, it's so funny that you need to add those, you know, sort of those descriptors to the beginning of it anyway. Well, I think that's a wonderful place to end. Thank you so much, Claire. This has been it's been such a pleasure talking to you today. Your wonderful recommendations, and I'm sure our listeners will have enjoyed them very much. And say thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks very much for having me. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thank you everyone else for listening. Our Shells is brought to you by the team at Virago Press. Special thanks to today's guest, Claire Chambers, and tune in next time for more conversation about books, feminism, and culture.